But nevertheless, like, it's still very interesting that as an outsider, you were already starting to lean that direction. I don't know. I think I find it interesting.
A lot of it actually had to do, too, with the reasons why I didn't like liberal Christianity were basically problems I just saw reoccurring with Protestantism, you know, where I didn't want to go with this intermediate option between liberal Christianity and, like, the full-blown, like, you know, apostolic Christianity, where there's an institutional church and, you know, you have like dogmas and councils and, you know, you have to submit to a bishop and that sort of stuff. I didn't want to go for this like intermediate option. And part of the reason for that was just like, it didn't. So one thing I think about, like I told you earlier, is I think in terms of these like stories of the meta narratives. And like, if it seemed to me that what Christ was trying to do was to like perpetuate the sort of these three roles that he had taken on into the future, past the apostolic age, which of these made more sense to me? That one, what he had done was, so take prophecy, king, priest. Those are three roles of Christ. There are three functions that I think the church has to carry out. And so then there are questions as to what design of the church, what structure of the church is going to equip it and to well dispose it to carry out those functions without like extraordinary interventions from God. So what's going to give the church the ordinary means to successfully accomplish those functions? And so with regard to prophecy or his role as prophet, basically there's a deposit of faith that he's entrusted to his apostles. And what's going to be the best way to safeguard that deposit? So to make sure that you don't have like an admixture of error that's going to creep in, and to have it to where just the faithful, even the lay faithful, including like illiterate peasants, are going to be able to get all the teaching and instruction that they need in a way that they can count on, that they can rely on, and where it's actually going to be reasonable to expect them to hearken to basically sound doctrine. So like where theology and doctrine can actually matter and where they're actually going to be preserved. So there's like an enduring and faithful witness to what Christ's teaching ministry and the apostles' teaching ministry. And what I realized was, like, it just seems extremely obvious to me, if you're not like coping like crazy, that like, just me and my Bible is not going to work, you know? So it's not going to work for like illiterate shepherds, you know? It's not going to work for the vast majority. Like, just before the printing press, there was a reason like Protestantism didn't get started, you know, which is it didn't work. Like, so if nobody can read the Bible, then this idea that Christ designed a system where everyone was supposed to be sitting in private judgment over a million competing sects that you wouldn't be able to recognize unless you had already created a systematic theology based on the exegesis of Greek and Latin for all the illiterate people all over the world, you know, no, these debates are too subtle. I mean, obviously there's the famous canon conundrum to begin with, but there's also just the issue that like private judgment as to arbitrating theological disputes just doesn't actually seem like a scalable or sensible way to ensure that all the faithful get the sound teaching that they need and to where it's like easily and immediately recognizable, like even to PhDs, you know, like even the PhDs can't agree amongst themselves and can devise all these competing warring theological schemes. And so if theology was going to matter, and if there was going to be a reasonable expectation for people to have basically sound doctrine and to prevent, not fall for heresy or not fall into schism, then the standard needed to be like a visible structure of authority that was basically saying, this guy's top dog, this is the court, like what he says goes, you know, Rome has decided the cause is finished, you know. So that type of structure is exactly what we needed. And then I look to the Bible and I say, okay, well, what do they do in the Bible? Like, how do they actually organize the church in the Bible? And then it's like, oh, Christ picks like a group of guys and says, whoever listens to you listens to me, whoever despises you despises me. And those guys go around by both word and letter, bossing people around and demanding faith and not having to justify themselves based on previous revelation. And then these guys are getting together and they're like holding councils. And like, we're being told like, okay, if you have a dispute, like try to work it out amongst yourselves. You can't do it. Go to the church. If they won't listen to the church, cast them out like a pagan or a tax collector. And I'm just like, how did anyone ever think that was like a good idea? Like this whole Protestant thing, it doesn't make any sense. It really didn't make much sense, especially if the New Testament church was like a prototype or a foundation. And then I look at the early church history and it's like, huh. And everybody in the world for hundreds of years has like these mono-episcopal bishops that are meeting in council. It's very interesting. And so just when I looked at that, I was just like, yeah, it's just for very, like, you know, I'm idiot level theology at this point. Like, I'm not a super well-researched theologian. I'm just like, the Protestant thing doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. And so that opened you up at least to, like, going down one of these apostolic routes. What's interesting about your story, and I'm kind of like jumping the gun a little bit, is that you weren't drawn like directly to Catholicism as a result of this, right? You were actually drawn to Coptic Orthodoxy. Tell us more about that.
Yeah. Well, so that was where I went, where I was inclined towards initially. And part of that was just due to the fact that at that time, the best miracle evidence that I was familiar with was like Coptic miracle workers, Our Lady of Zaitun. Like, that was all the stuff that I was familiar with. And so that already lent a credibility to it. I mean, in addition to that, like, I almost felt like I was personally being called to the Coptic Church, just because, like, at all these key moments in my faith journey, it was like a Coptic Orthodox guy that was there that was like provided me with the advice that I needed at that time, you know? And then it turns out at the time when I'm working through all this, like, what are the odds? There's like a Coptic Orthodox church, like, right across the street from my house. So, and so it's crazy in that regard.
Did you attend any Coptic masses or?
Well, no, and actually that's interesting. So I'll get to that in a second, to Coptic liturgy. And so I'll get to that, because there's even like an element of providential coincidence in that. But basically I start inquiring, and I'm in the early stages of inquiring, and that's where I'm heading. And part of it is the miracle evidence. Part of it is just like personally, like, I'm getting all these weird indications that I should like look into the Copts. And then the third thing was just like Catholicism, when your faith is weak, when you're not really sure about apostolic Christianity or like dipping your toe in the water, Catholicism is a tough pill to swallow, because it's like, you know, I could get volumes and volumes of doctrine that I was going to have to accept and submit to, and that was going to be radically counterintuitive from the sort of liberal starting position that I was in. And you basically had way less wiggle room within the Catholic system to basically be either to be liberal, like as liberal as possible, which is kind of where I was at, or to be a little bit Mysterian, like, don't worry about it. Like, doctrine's not what's important. Like, just, you know, feel it. Don't try to understand it. You know, so to be more mysterious. So I felt like that was more possible within Coptic Orthodoxy, where the commitments that I, like the dogmatic commitments I had, were way more minimal. So it was just less of a pill to swallow, which also just made it easier. But basically, I was planning even that Easter. So like last Easter, not this most recent Easter, but the Easter before, I was planning on going to a Coptic liturgy because that was the direction that I was trending. But it turns out, for whatever reason, I was unable to attend the Coptic liturgy. I can't remember all the circumstances surrounding it. But for some reason, the only place I could go was Catholic Mass. So that's where I wound up going instead. And then for some reason, basically, I think God, in his providence, I just felt compelled to keep going back week after week to this St. Peter's Catholic Church in New Brunswick, and going there. And so then I really started thinking to myself, like, okay, well, all my reasons that I've sort of worked out for myself right now are copped, but I'm also feeling this weird draw towards the Catholic Church. And I also have always had like this like subconscious association with the Catholic Church and like truth in all caps, you know? So I have positive mental associations with the Catholic Church. So then I'm like, okay, well, I really should figure this out. Cause there's a part of me where I can tell, like, Catholicism kind of is the main character, you know, and it's like, okay, come on, this is like a little weird. Like, you're going to go be part of this, like, you know, ethnic cult that's like Egyptian and you're not Egyptian. Like, what is going on? Like, and so then I just start inquiring into it further. I'm like, okay, well, at least I should take a step back and try to figure out what's going on. Oh, important context for everybody. My Baptist, at least from the Catholic perspective, my Baptist baptism was invalid, because they had said we baptize rather than I baptize. So that's why I had to be baptized at the Easter Vigil. So I'm a Catholic neophyte now. So I'm going to be baptized. But anyways, I'm saying, okay, well, it's probably really important, actually, that like I get this right before I commit to the tradition, because there's probably going to be like way more inertia in changing once I start heading down one of these paths. And so I may just get myself stuck to where this is probably the most open-minded I'm ever going to be able to be when evaluating which of these traditions is true. and I'm just a good rationalizer. Like, I can talk myself into being convinced of whatever I want to believe. So I need to be really careful to make sure while I'm in this stage where I still am open that I actually find the true thing, because it really matters actually that I find the true one, given the exclusive claims that are being made by all these churches. And the thing that really starts to get me is really thinking about like the marks of the church or the notes, you know, by which the visible church is to be recognized. So as I already explained, with apostolic Christianity, I was totally convinced that there needed to be an institutional church, that that institutional church had normative authority, that the promises that Christ had made to the church were to this like corporate body of the institutional, visible, hierarchical church that would have a visible continuity through time and that would sort of organize itself and conduct itself along the similar pattern as the church in the New Testament. Totally convinced of all that. But then in addition, a thing that follows from that, that's a corollary of that, of which I was also convinced, was that the visibility of the church means that if there is one true church of Christ, and that's going to be necessary for the church to perform the functions that I said it needed to, then we need signs that are going to scream out to people, hey, this is the real one, that like even an idiot could apply. You know, you don't need to be like a super duper trained theologian where it's like, I've studied everything that St. Cyril wrote about miaphysitism, and I know this formula from Pope Damascene and blah, 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 blah. Like, I realized the argument for what the true church was, like, regardless of how good I could get at all those arguments, regardless of how much I could dig into the patristic sources and how much systematic theology I could do and how great my exegesis would be on all these passages, that those are like almost like the wrong sorts of arguments if any church is going to be visibly recognizable as the true church of Christ. They just need to be like really obvious, really dumb, like intuitive signs, and a bunch of them that we can apply to adjudicate between these competing claims to be the true church of Christ. And so, and part of that is the best guy ever to write about this was St. Bellarmine. And he has a basically 150 pages like on the marks of the church. And he does a great job, a great treatment of it. And part of it is you start to realize that the marks, so first thing that I noticed was really deficient in all the Orthodox people I was talking to and all the Coptic people, and they never could really give me a good answer, was like how the marks of the church within the Coptic paradigm functioned as basically proper marks without actually just presupposing, like without becoming unpracticable. So by practicable, I mean they're the sorts of things that could be applied by a layman who hadn't done a scientific examination of like a very subtle theological controversy, right? And so what I didn't get a good answer as to how you could make an argument from these notes of the church for Coptic Orthodoxy specifically that wouldn't be unpracticable, wouldn't get to the point where like obviously we can say, what it is for us to be apostolic is to preach the faith of the apostles, and miaphysitism is more faithful to the faith of the apostles. So therefore we have, but that's not a practicable interpretation of that mark. And so, and another thing is just like another argument that I saw them do was they would go and they would be like, well, if we look at like the early church or we look at the early centuries of the church, we'll see that if you tried to appeal to like Catholicity as a mark for the Catholic Church right now, that we would lack that mark then. So if that disqualifies us as the church now, you're disqualifying the early church. But I noticed all those arguments. Now, there's ways to respond to that and to nuance it and to clarify what you're meaning to make arguments for Catholicism that don't wind up having that undesirable feature. But what I noticed was, hey, this is kind of suspicious. It seems like the Catholics want to make positive arguments for their worldview using all these marks. And it seems like what you want to do is almost like minimize and discredit the entire concept of marks by showing how if you try to apply it historically, it gets too convoluted. And so therefore, none of these arguments work. But that's not how the church fathers argued. And obviously, it's kind of nonsensical if the church really is going to be visible, that this is how you would recognize it through this like scientific investigation of miaphysitism. So it's suspicious to me that your entire approach seems to be discrediting the marks, which is an indication to me that maybe you guys don't have them, or the only thing that you have are what are called like common marks, right? So marks that like multiple churches could have at the same time. But in order for the marks to do what they're supposed to do, they have to be proper marks. So they have to be things that are either possessed uniquely or preeminently by the true church, because that's the way that they're actually going to serve to distinguish the true church from the rivals. And that doesn't need to be true for all the marks at all times in history. But it needs to be something where if I looked at the whole history of the church and I looked at the full constellation of Marx, it would actually just be reasonable for me to say, you know, this is the one holy Catholic and apostolic church, just based off of that cursory examination rather than very subtle examination of history. And so like I'll give an example. I won't go through all of this because it would be a stream unto itself to develop the theology of Marx, you know, as fully as I would need to. But one of the things is, okay, let's just take unity as a mark. So the Catholics actually had a very good, unique claim upon which they can base an argument for uniquely or preeminently possessing unity among all the apostolic churches, which is it's just a feature of Catholic governance that we're claiming, rooted in Petrine primacy, the Bishop of Rome is like the super bishop who nobody can sit in judgment of him, and he can bind everybody to his judgments. And so he can bind the universal church. He has universal jurisdiction over the whole church. And he's kind of like the buck stops with me, final guy. And this is a unique way to ensure unity because it ensures that it's always feasible. So first, we always know whether we're in communion with the true church or not, just based on whether we're in communion with that guy, whoever the successor to that office is. Second is this guy can actually, in a real feasible way, constantly settle controversies and ensure that we're all on the same page about doctrine. And in fact, it seems like the magisterium of the Catholic Church has continued to perform that function in a way that none of the Orthodox churches have. And in fact, they can't even do these, like they struggle to even do like pan-Orthodox synods at this point. You know, so it seems like the Catholic Church actually can continue performing the magisterial role that the church is supposed to perform precisely because it has this principle of unity in the Petrine primacy. And this then clarifies for us what an argument from a distinguishing mark is really going to look like. So there's some special feature that's singular to the Catholic Church that has some grounding in history that basically it seems like in virtue of this, the Catholic Church is teleologically ordered towards unity and has the necessary means to achieve unity, morally speaking, in a way that other churches lack. And then if we looked at the full course of history, not that there are individual controversies that have yet to be resolved at any given time, not that there aren't internal schisms in the body or whatever, but that the teaching function of the church and the unity of faith of the church, rather than having to like calcify or just become this like sedimentary rock at any point in history, can continue to develop, can continue to behave like a living organism while retaining a unity. And that type of argument was really appealing to me. And it is one of these more conceptual, big picture arguments rather than the super nitty gritty. Like, I also just think like the Orthodox love to make fun of this, but this is exactly the tier of argument that like good argument for a church should have. Exactly the tier of argument is the Mackey's argument. You know, you are Peter. Upon this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it. And then we find Peter's bones buried underneath the Vatican. Like, that's my idiot level argument. Like, upon this rock I will build my church. We're making the Petrine claims. We're built on top of Peter in Rome. That's the level of art. Yeah, the Mackey's argument. You guys make fun of it as much as you want. Because when there's just a really simple argument that devastates people who are super fancy pants, I'm Dr. Fatbottom, whatever, then they just start mocking it as a simpleton argument. But I think the right argument is going to be a simpleton argument. And the Mackey's argument satisfies the criteria.
So did that at that point, did you feel confident in your like becoming Catholic, or were there other considerations, or was it mainly like these signs or the markers?
I became more and more convinced the more I thought about it, you know. And like another big one was like Catholicity, where like I really didn't like that like the Oriental Orthodox Communion didn't feel like a universal church. Like, it very much felt like an ethnic clique. And that was very much the vibe and impression I had. And meanwhile, when I went to the Catholic Church, like, yeah, like I could go anywhere in the world and it was the same church. And like, yeah, it felt like we were all Catholics. Like, we weren't American Catholics, you know, we weren't like British Catholics, we weren't German Catholics, we weren't Ethiopian Catholic. We were Catholics first, and then we were whatever else we were, you know. And so there was something appealing about that.
Did you have any other religious experiences past the first one that you had reading that mathematician's book?
Well, nothing nearly as dramatic as that, where I would actually call it like there's the normal levels of providential coincidence and like people are praying and, you know, and like stuff. So there's normal levels of that, but like nothing where it was like I felt like it was like a paranormal experience.
What were your experiences when you went to Catholic Mass? Did you have any experiences of the beauty of the Eucharist or anything like that?
That at that time, like early on, no. I mean, there was like
what a piece. I'm just curious. When you went to Mass, were you skeptical of real presence, or were you like, man, if this church is so, and maybe this is just idiosyncratic to my own story. When I was Protestant and I was attending Mass, I would just go in there and I'd be like, that might be Jesus, you know? And I was like, whoa, that's insane if that's true. And man, I got to like kind of figure this out. Did you have any experience like that?
I mean, I came to appreciate the Eucharist, like, and Eucharistic theology, like way more once I was already like really firm in Catholicism. And so once I started looking into the miracle evidence, and like I was actually basically, you know, where I am right now is like I have no doubt at all whatsoever in my mind that Catholicism is true, you know, and it'd been that way for a while. And so it's just like, you know, like Catholicism not true, like earth is flat, like, you know, like it's just not, it doesn't compute. And like, so it, past that point, that's when I started to appreciate it more. And like my first time receiving the Eucharist was a very powerful experience for me. But like, it wasn't a big part of my conversion journey, I wouldn't say.
Yeah. Interesting. Hmm. So are we all caught up? Are you now full blown Catholic, or, you know, not necessarily confirmed or anything, but, you're at this point, you're gung ho.
Yeah. At this point in the journey, I was pretty confident that I made the right decision. And then basically after I made the decision, like it just felt like everything was confirming me in that